guys. Yes. Oh. Quick, don't touch anything. So what was that?
No, you just put it in the jar and back up in the fridge.
Yeah, okay.
I think you need to come in and pick it up after you finish it, put it back on the box.
Great. Hi, my name is Steve Middleton. This is some of my work. So recent work that was on at Heidi Gallery last year. I've been working with robotics for about 20 years now, one way or another. Naturally, we use a lot of embedded systems in this. I hardly know where to start. Probably the most important thing here is a MIDI controller that controls the speech. Now, this is called the walking head. We have a series of robots like this that carries a representation of a human head on six legs. What I'm trying to do is talk about what it means to be human, using this sort of alien mechanism to draw out some characteristics about what it means to be human. You can have a conversation with this if you get close enough and start talking to it. I had plans to have a conversation on AI here today, but I think there's far too many problems with the AV system to set it up. We'll see you later. I'm interested in software and hardware robots. Like I said, this draws out some story about us, what it means for us to be human. One of the things you can say for sure about equipment like this is it shows how clever we are. We can build things like this. I think a lot of research into artificial intelligence and robotics is less about the machines and more about us.
Walk around with me. Walk. Just hold it there.
You're about to see this. I wanted to show this clip first. You're about to see this robot go wrong.
Keep going.
This is actually crashed and it's about to walk off its podium. One of the disadvantages of using autonomous equipment as works of art is that you really can't control what they do a lot. Yes, and there it goes. That's interesting, huh? How do I stop this? Sorry? One of the interesting things about using equipment like this is the amount of things that can go wrong. So a whole lot of things went wrong with this bit of equipment for it to walk off the podium. But we had it going for, I think, 4 months at Heidi Gallery last year, a couple of hours a day. It was fairly robust. We take a long time making equipment like this for display. This is all basically stainless steel, and was made in Germany by some friends got a company called F18. We are at the opposite end of the robotics industry to, I guess, everybody else in the room here. Rather than work with industry, we work in the arts, and quite a high-level arts too. It takes this piece cost about $40,000 to make, so we need a vast amount of funding before we even start to make this, and we usually need a special event to make it for. They usually commission for some special event. This was commissioned for a kind of centenary of Australian art last year that was at Heidi Gallery. It's been on in Adelaide since, and it's now walking its way across Europe, starting in Berlin, and ending in London and England sometime next year. One of the benefits of working with equipment like this for us is we can really, like, it's really out there. It's a really big bit of equipment. It really makes a big spectacle. And when you see an autonomous machine moving in an autonomous way, it really does start to raise questions about what is autonomy? What does it mean to be human? Why are we humans and that isn't? I mean, the robots we make exhibit a lot of the characteristics of what people think is sentience. In other words, moves of its own volition, has behaviour that comes from inside, not outside, and reacts to stimuli. So one of the things I was interested in when we started this work 10 or 15 years ago was what is intelligence? What does it mean to be intelligent? Well, I'm still no better off now than I was 10 or 15 years ago because we don't know. The more we know about intelligence, the less we know about it. But these machines are classified as artificially intelligent. I mean, they're intelligent in ways we are. And I want to make the point that we see this robot walking off its podium, we say it's broken, it's made a mistake, as if we're talking about a real person making a mistake or a real person breaking. The robot doesn't know it's on the podium. All it knows is the sensory information it's getting. If something goes wrong with one of the sensors, that's it. It'll walk off its podium. So we're not as good as everybody reckons. Our machines do break. Our artificial intelligence is probably not as smart as the average mouse, really. Average mouse can run along the fence without falling off it. The average bird sits on the branch without falling off it. We can't put one of these mechanisms anywhere without attending to it and virtually putting on life support for 6 months. The life support analogy is pretty good because when Deep Blue, the Deep Blue computer, beat Boris Spassky a few years ago playing chess, you might remember it was the end of humanity as we know it. Machines were as smart as us. Well, the real story is there, the machine was on life support for about 3 weeks. It crashed after every move. I mean, it was probably a bit worse than the equipment here, which is crashing after every video. We just can't make this equipment yet as good as we're made. So the more we make artificial life, the more we find out that our own lives are something special. So I'm going to play another video here, probably take my life into my own hands, but how do I do this? Yeah. I never use Windows Media Player usually. Where these come from, I'll just show you a prototype. I want to talk about Tom Braunel's work for a second. It's not there. Oh, great, okay. Okay, we've made some prototypes of all this stuff over the years. This is a prototype from, I think, 1999, 2000. Basically using an iBot controller here from the University of Western Australia, Tom Braunel, if you've heard of him. The iBot people are great from using, as far as I know, this is the only mobile robot controller made in Australia, totally made and programmed by the UWA. Tom Braunel's also got a book out called Embedded Robotics, which is really, really handy if you're dealing with robotic systems. It's got a lot of really cool algorithms in it. These mechanisms are fairly straightforward to program. We program in the C language. C++ actually, because we need to use threads with them. Good grief. Oh yeah, it's a shadow. It's no big deal getting the six legs to move in sync. This is a 1 megabyte of RAM. Usually has a camera in it. It's what I call an iBot. It's the same controller that's used in the soccer. If anyone's been to the robot soccer, uses extensively in robot soccer to find the ball and find the wall and find the goal. It works quite well. I think they're up to about revision 8 or 9, anyone considering using robotics. Controllers, you know, sophisticated robotic controllers, we need reliability. I think Tom Brunel's gear is really good. Apart from the manufacturing they do in West Australia, there's a good unit at the electrical engineering at the UWA, which deals with mobile and embedded robots. They used to be very big in the soccer. I'm not sure where they're up to now. But they've been working a lot with aircraft, artificially intelligent aircraft drones you can send up for 15 or 20 hours to watch the coastline. Just a shot of the sensors here. We use simple, straightforward Polaroid sensors. These are passive infrared. Oh, I'm sorry, they're active infrared. They send out a beam of infrared light, measure the time it takes to get there and back if they detect it again. That's how far away something is. So a mechanism like this can navigate in the world.
It's not
Not with any... Yeah, not convincingly, but it can navigate in the world. They can protect themselves from harm. The bottom sensors keep it from falling off the table. And the sensors on the front stop it walking into anything. This is a very, very simple mechanism. There would be only about 1,000 lines of code driving this, if that. It's extraordinarily simple to make these devices get around in the world and do something. I'll show you another one, if I can. One with wheels. Robots, basically three kinds of robots. One floats using helium, one's got wheels, one's got legs. So these are all sort of methods of getting around in the world. Wheeled robots have a fairly interesting history. First made in the 1950s for use in experiments in psychology. What happens when a robot follows a light? Well, it teaches all sorts of interesting things about how we behave. We make these things to study how we behave, characteristically. We don't really make them to study how robots behave. Interesting thing about, this is about 10 years old, this one I think, maybe 10 years ago. One of the interesting things this one does is it got a passive infrared sensor tuned to the wavelength of human heat, about 98 nanometers, I think, from memory. It seeks out humans and tries to sing to them. When it gets close, it'll burble on, make all these little tinkling noises. It tested this extensively at the Animation and Interactive Media Center at RMIT over about 2 years, and it was a kind of pet up there. People treated it like a pet. They loved it when it beeped at it. They loved it, and they'd become concerned when it became stuck under chairs and so forth. So, yeah, this is an early video, but it ended up covered in stickers. People liked it. They used to stick stickers on it. Got a range of about 2.5 hours. One of the interesting things about dealing with mechanisms like this, interacting with people, is that people will anthropomorphize them. They will say, look at something that moves and think it's alive. There's been a lot of talk lately in the press I've heard about the uncanny valley. That's measurements on a graph that sort of goes down. The more realistic a robot gets, the less people like it. If you measure this on a graph of how much people like the robot, you see the line going down, they call it a valley. This is actually based on an idea by Sigmund Freud. Freud recognised fairly early on in his work that anything that moves of its own volition and has a motivation we don't understand will make the hairs on the back of our neck stand up. It's uncanny. It feels wrong. Part of the work involved around this robot, which is just called the Black Robot, was seeing how people did react to it. And what we found out was that people will, rather than being freaked out and scared, they'll start anthropomorphising. It's a cat, it's a dog, it's a pet, it's like my pet, it's like my dad's pet, it's like my friend's pet. You heard this a lot of statements to do with this, and somehow this mechanism turned from being a machine into, you know, a thing, into something flesh and blood. So like I said, people would be concerned if it disappeared under a chair and didn't come out. They get worried and come and get me and say, oh, the robot's broken, you want to come and fix it? Oh, it's hurt itself. We look at mechanisms like this and we see ourselves. We look at things that move, we know that we move around. We anthropomorphise. We say, this is like us. It starts to lose its association of being a made object, if you like, and get some of the properties of being created objects. I mean, just equal with anything else in the world. This is a fairly straightforward little mechanism, actually. 68332 processor, no, I might be wrong, no, I think it's HC16 processor, Motorola anyway, pretty old, about 30 years old. I'm using here something called a handy board from MIT, which is set up, which I think they still make, you can still get from MIT, which is made especially for experiments with mobile robots. Once again, using the C language, no threads with this, it's all process, interrupt driven though, very interesting little chip. Working with embedded processors for the last 20 years like I have, interrupt driven chips are just as good as ones that implement threads in the language. This is totally driven by hardware interrupts, it's totally driven by sensory input. In a very straightforward way, the software just goes over the inputs and polls them every X milliseconds, and that's how we get the behaviour. The only sensors on here are some resistors, light-sensitive resistors, and a passive infrared detector tuned to the human body. Autonomous robots are really interesting to work with, though, like I said, because they... For me as an artist, it creates all sorts of problems, all sorts of oppositions. If you work as an installation artist, the big thing is you make things in opposites, you know, this is opposite of that. That's how installation art works. Well, we have living, not living, alive, dead, moving, not moving. I love the opposites here. Another sort of strand in my work is the cyborg. That is the idea that we can couple a machine to a body and have the machine act as a proxy for the body or a prosthesis for the body or as an addition to the body, an addendum to the body. And I work pretty extensively, and I have done for years, with an Australian performance artist called Stellark. I don't know if you've heard of him, you can look at our website anyway. He's got a history of making third arms, so he can write his name with three arms. It's a good trick. And we've also made a couple of very large robots which turn his two legs into six legs. And I'm just going to show you one of the prototypes of that. Yeah, it's all right. So, do a lot of virtual reality. This is an intermediate step in one of the robots we made. We got all of this costs a very unreasonable amount of money to make this stuff. So, anytime you want to do a project like this, we've basically got to go worldwide, groveling with hands out there, and, oh, please give us, you know, $100,000, please give us $50,000. And I mean, you have to make up all sorts of excuses as to why we need it. And been had all sorts of adventures with this sort of stuff too, like getting involved with Italian royalty and having them run away with all the money. And it's been an extraordinary journey because this stuff is really expensive. And this is the video that convinced the Wellcome Foundation, big charitable trust funded by a drug company basically in England, to give us nearly $2 million to make this for real, this robot. This is from, I think, 2001. And characteristically, what I do is I put together some sort of demo to convince the suits, oh yeah, we can probably got a shot to do this. And this is the demo. We worked with three universities, RMIT, the University of Sussex, I hope that's right, in Brighton in England, the cognitive science unit there, and the University of Nottingham, Trent, the digital research unit there, to realise two of these robots. They cost lots of money. This one actually didn't work. We really blew it with the design. It was, just to put this in perspective, this ended up about 9 metres, from tip to tip of the legs, elevated 3.5 metres, that's to the base where Stark stood on it, and it was just too bloody big, and we fired it up and the whole thing like tore itself to bits within minutes. And we mended it and fired it up again. It tore itself to bits within minutes again. So I think you'd have to say that design wasn't quite right. We spent $1 million on it too, and people weren't happy, I tell you. Weren't happy at all. So working internationally with equipment like this, you tend to meet a lot of really, really bright people, and it's a really humbling experience working with some of these big research labs in Australia and overseas. What we did, we had what amounts to a 2-month video conference all over the world trying to figure out what went wrong with this design and how to come up with another one. And we ended up involving undergraduate and grad students from two universities. And there was a huge amount of input, and we figured out that the big problem here was that we had a guy standing on top there. So, because not only was the weight, you know, it was an unreasonable amount of weight to carry, but also we were transferring the motion of his legs into the motion of the six big legs, and it wasn't quite working out for us. No idea why the video's doing that. Wasn't quite working out for us. So what we thought we'd do is, and this was an undergraduate student came up with this one day. We're on a conference going spin it. Oh, does it have to walk on top? Why can't it walk on the ground? Such a brilliant idea, right? Well, if we'd have thought of that straight away, we would have saved at least $1 million. No, really. Because, of course, there was no difference, but part of the difficulty in working artistically with equipment like this is it's fairly unprecedented, and you can't look back through history and go, oh, gee, that guy did it that way, he didn't do it that way, so that might be a dead end. There's no precedent. We have to really follow what we reckon. I think I'm using a QuickTime player now. Good heavens. But anyway, putting this guy on the ground, that was a masterstroke. We actually managed to build this machine, and I've got a DVD of it, and the DVD's broken. Can't get it playing, and it looks gorgeous too, but sorry about that. But we had to kind of wrap our heads around that the mechanism wasn't for carrying people around. Once we worked out that it wasn't a sort of vehicle, that it was actually an object we could wrap around a person, everything fell into place. And we realised that, and this was over here, I think 2 years ago, doing performances. And this is a fairly substantial machine. It's a pity you can't see the real pictures. Totally made out of stainless steel. This big mechanism, absolutely precision made. It's so precise, the room has to be at the right temperature for all the parts to fit together on there. It's amazing. Like I said, very, very humbling experience working worldwide with so many bright people doing this. Am I running out of time? Good heavens.
I've been
I was going to show you it's air driven. So you've got a compressor and the air comes through valves. He's moving his feet. That's driving the valves to move the big legs. It makes a really big noise. And part of the magic of working with air like that is, of course, you can put all sorts of reeds and devices in the pipes and you can make them sing. I mean, once you start working with equipment like this, there's no end to the amount of, you know, stuff you can do with it. It's still in Australia. I'm not sure that we've got any money to actually show it. It costs about $5,000 just to wheel it out, you know, by the time we've got a compressor out there and stuff. The working with technology like this is really hideously expensive, like I said. So you have to really grovel and, you know, get as much money as you can together and then take a huge risk and really see if you can pull it off. Yeah, and often we don't pull it off. I mean, it's just a pile of junk, and what can we say? Oh, sorry.
$1 million
being artists, we can generally come up with, you know, a bit of bullshit to carry. I want to stress that these aren't mission critical devices. There's no one life depending on this, you know. The sun will still rise in the morning if they don't work. Nothing depends on it except, you know, probably our egos and reputations or whatever. But I just wanted to show you, finally, another sort of strand of my work. Is that all right? Have I got time?
Yeah. I'm next,
though. Okay. I thought it was... what's happened here? Have I got sound here, do you know? Okay, so another sort of area of the work we're interested in is the idea of the software agent or the conversational agent. About 15 years research into avatars and what we can do to make a user experience more
version
kind of
0.11 and stable is ready.
So we've got this kind of mechanism here, which is a software robot. Well, okay. one of the interesting areas dealing with this is that idea of the uncanny, and are things scary, aren't they? But so yeah, a bit scary. But if you get it to tell you a joke,
light travels faster than sound. This is why some people appear bright until you hear them speak.
Okay. So we've got a robot that tells a joke. Straight away, that's less threatening, right? So, I mean, it's less... less okay. We think it is. We're sort of experimenting with this...
Cross-country skiing is great if you live in a small country.
So, in an art gallery, people go into a dark room, you can have a conversation with this, just like you can with, you know, a chatterbot on the round. Yeah, big head, about, you know, 5-6 metres big. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit scary. A few versions of this, one's really mild-mannered, hello, how are you, you know, really mild-mannered. This is in your face, I don't know how to get it to be in your face.
Bite my shiny plastic ass.
It's what it's likely to come out with, right? We found that the sort of rude one and the nice one more or less work the same way. I mean, people engage with them, they become a little bit more than a face on the screen or a bit of software, if you like. And that's the sort of, that's what I'm on about, like making art out of these embedded systems, these little robots. It's a bit of fun, you know, it's an adventure, it's, you know, it's definitely good for the mind and very intellectually stimulating, but also it allows me to ask and answer questions about what it means to be human. Thanks. That's about all I've got to say. Yeah, I'll take questions if you want. I'm sorry? No, I haven't got a DVD player on a laptop. The problem is the DVD player here is broken.
Yeah, we've got two DVD players there. One doesn't have a mouse and keyboard.
Yeah.